Thierry Henry used to like to come out to the left-hand side. And about 10 minutes to go, he's running down the line. I think, I've got him here, I'm going to take everything. So as I'm coming, he's seen it. He's chipped the ball over me as I'm diving. He's turned round. He's waved his finger at me as if to say, you can't do that to me.
Welcome, everybody, to the More Than A Name podcast. Now, you join us at the very beginning of our journey. So first, of course, an introduction. I'm Max Whittle. I have a decade-plus career working in sports media, starting out as an avid listener turned producer at TalkSport. I was then a video journalist at The Guardian, and I now work as a presenter and commentator across football, tennis, cricket, and many others. My co-host and running mate for this show is the one and only Luke Young, who I used to watch from the whole tend as a Villa fan. Luke represented Spurs, Charlton, Middlesbrough, Aston Villa, QPR and England across a 17-year career as a defender. All but one of his 379 appearances came in the Premier League. More on that later, Luke. On this show, we're going to be welcoming athletes from a variety of sports, coaches, public figures, dare I say it, referees as well, to talk about the emotional and mental weight of being in the sporting spotlight. We'll be discussing the side of success fans rarely see: identity, pressure, mental health, and the moments our guests felt most lost. Now, while Luke will usually be asking the questions alongside me, today he'll be answering them. I wanted to do the first show this way, Luke, because since retiring from professional football in 2014, the football world hasn't really heard from you. So where have you been?
Disappeared a little bit. I've never really spoke about my career in any depth, so looking forward to it. I had the England cap in my boy's bedroom, actually, so I picked that up on the way.
You haven't had that traditional post-career media work or coaching with a former team. So, yeah, how do you feel about doing this pod?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, growing up, I was always obsessed with sport, any sport. So that's never left me. So recently went to watch the British and Irish Lions play rugby. I'm always watching the cricket, the tennis, obviously the football. So I've always been a huge sports fan. So I'm looking forward to speaking and asking some questions on people's journeys.
Yeah, Luke went from Europe to Australia and back again within, what, 3 or 4 days?
Yeah, I went with my boy. He wasn't very happy about it when we were sat on the planes for sort of 2 days there, 2 days back. But a great experience. And it was the second test where it was an incredible finish for the Lions, and they wrapped up the series win.
Keen to say as well that we are welcoming professionals from many sports. This is the question I'm going to ask all of our guests to really start us off. So in the context of your career, when you hear your name, Luke Young, what springs to mind?
Oof, good question. I almost feel like a different person now. So when I look back at games, I don't actually resonate with that guy that's running around who I'm watching. It feels like a lifetime ago. Fully enjoyed my footballing career. At times, obviously, the pressures of trying to compete at the highest levels are difficult to deal with, that most elite sportsmen go through. But when I look back now, I just got probably quite proud that I managed to have the career that I did and to go on to play for such, you know, top teams in the Premier League and represent England and stuff like that. If you'd have said that to the 8, 9, 10-year-old Luke Young that he was going to do that, I don't think he would have quite believed you.
Well, we'll get into it. You finished your career with QPR in the early 2010s. So many stories to get into about that club. Was there any fatigue, though, from or resentment towards football as you neared the end of your playing career?
Yeah, I would say there was. I struggled with hip pain and stiffness in my hips for the majority of my career, which became a little bit tiring towards the end. And I had some operations at QPR and the hip never really quite recovered. So I spent a couple of years towards the end basically just going in, training with sort of the under-21s, knowing that I was never going to get back to the elite level. When you come back from injury, you know yourself, I was like 10% off of where you needed to be, but that 10% at elite level is huge. I wasn't going to put any pressure on the first team anymore. So that was a tough period of my career towards the end, knowing that in your own mind that you've kind of had your day and there's nothing you can do about it other than keep going in and training and seeing where that could take you. But deep down, I think I knew that my best days were behind me and that I wasn't going to play first team football again. So it was tough, but you know, you get on with it and it's part and parcel of being, you know, an elite sportsman is that you're going to have injuries.
What is the most bizarre story you can tell me from that time there?
It was almost like there was daily stories, you know. When I first signed at QPR, I felt like it was going to be a newly promoted side. Everyone was going to be in it together. The whole remit was to stay in the Premier League and was going to be... They already had a real strong set of lads that had got them up, and I thought that I'd be adding to that and we'd all be in it together. And for the first 6 months, it kind of felt like that. Obviously, Neil Warnock got sacked around about Christmas time, and then Mark Hughes signs another load of players. So when I arrived, there was already, we call it a bomb squad. So there was already a group of players that Neil Warnock didn't want. So by the time Mark Hughes comes in, he then decides there's another group of players that he doesn't want. So you've got two sets of players that are not training with the first team, and you're buying more and more players as well. So before you know it, you've got 30 pros in the building. I was one of the unlucky ones when Mark Hughes came in, and we was put into like a separate dressing room.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, some of the other lads weren't even training at the same sort of times as the regular squad. That when I arrived, there was like Danny Shittu, Martin Rowlands, like some Rob Hull, some real like experienced players that weren't training with us. And then when Mark Hughes came in, there was another group of players that got sidelined. Another load of lads got bought. Some coming probably for the wrong reasons, because unfortunately the chairman at the time, he was spending big, but he was giving big wages out as well. So I think a lot of agents jumped on the fact that this is a great place to get my player. And before you knew it, there wasn't really the same feeling as when I first went in there about we're all here to try and stay up. It was like people were coming for the money a little bit.
Let's have a look at some of those names. Ji-Sung Park, Loic Remy, Chris Samba, Gibril Cissé, Julio Cesar. How do you go about fitting in to a team like that? And is it important to find your close mates early on?
So many players were coming at every window that there was no time to integrate everyone. And it never felt like it was a squad feeling, in my opinion, when I was there. And tried to run before it could walk, basically. And I think panicked and tried to buy players to try and stay up on ludicrous wages that the club could never sustain. If you think about Loftus Road, I don't know what it holds. I think it's like 22,000, but you're not getting the revenue to give Cesar 100 grand a week or whatever it is. You know, these were the types of figures that were getting thrown around, and it's the bright lights of London as well, you know. So I think some of the lads got caught up in that as well. So yeah, difficult time in my career, because one, I was injured and couldn't do anything about it anyway, but two, to watch the club kind of self-destruct, it wasn't good viewing.
You were playing for QPR in 2011 against Chelsea. Now, this is the game where John Terry was caught on camera using a racist slur in your teammate Anton Ferdinand's direction. Now, Anton didn't hear it during the match, but this moment became a national story. The footage was there for all to see, complaints came in, and Terry was eventually charged and put on trial by the Crown Prosecution Service. He was acquitted in July 2012 of racially aggravated public order offences. However, he was stripped of the England captaincy and found guilty by the Football Association of using abusive and or insulting words, which, quote, included a reference to the ethnic origin and or colour and or race of Ferdinand. Terry was eventually banned for 4 games, fined £220,000. Let's talk about the on-pitch events first. So where were you when this all unfolded?
Apparently, I was one of the closest players to the incident. During the game, no one knew of what had taken place. I don't think even Anton had heard anything until, I think, after the game, where he started receiving messages, I believe, from friends. A couple of days later, the FA arrive at the training ground and they make me personally aware that I was one of the closest players to the incident, which I had no idea about. So they basically asked you, what did you hear? What did you see? What do you think? And I had no answers for them, really, because as I mentioned to you before, no one really knew what had happened and what had taken place. And it was more the cameras and, you know, before you know it, people are reading John's lips and did he say it? Did he not say it? The only person who knows what he said is John. But when you look at, I don't know whether Anton would say the same, but I think when you look at his career after that event and before that event, it kind of took a a downward spiral for him, which is a shame because, you know, an innocent party in something, but I don't think he quite recovered and played to the levels that he was playing at the time. We'd go to away games and he was still getting stick. I don't know why, but he was getting stick and it kind
from
of...
From the fans or...?
I think so. Obviously from the Chelsea fans, if we're going to play Chelsea. Larger than life character, Anton. So if something was troubling him, you would never ever know. He'd bounce in the training ground, super loud, having a laugh, having banter with everyone. So obviously he was a little bit more down at this stage, but it was really difficult, like I say, to tell how Anton's feeling. And
maybe this is a wider issue then. At the time, at least, it's a dressing room full of male football players. Do you think if he was, and he clearly was struggling, do you think he'd feel open enough to talk to you guys about it? Or maybe it was just for his family, but how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think back in that era, you didn't really show any signs of weakness that you're struggling with anything. Obviously, the lads were there to be around him for the way he was feeling and try and pick him up for training, really. You're thinking, oh, let's pick Anton up. We've got a session in a minute, or we've got a game Saturday. Let's try and get around him a bit. But I think that was more the family rallying around him. Just a shame, really, that it took place. He was an innocent party in it, but yeah, it affected him. Perhaps his career might have been a bit different if that incident hadn't happened.
QPR is where your Premier League playing record was tarnished. Tell us more.
I hadn't played, I think, for at least a year and a half. And Harry Redknapp came to me and I was training with the 21s. He said, listen, Youngie, we've got Blackburn away on Tuesday night. Everyone's injured. Will you play for me? So I've gone, of course I will. Yeah, no problem. But I did say to him, like, you've got a young lad there who's coming through the ranks. I think his name was Cole Donaldson. We'd bought him from Scotland. And I said, well, why don't you just play Cole? Like, if you're going to play me, like 34, one hip. You might. So anyway, I've travelled with a team and we're going for food or something. And Bobby Zamora comes up to me and I'm talking to Bobby and he says, you playing today? I said, yeah. He said, you ever played in the Championship before? I went, no, never. He said, what? So all of your games are in the Prem. So I've gone, yeah. He's gone, don't play. I said, what do you mean don't play? He said, you can't play. I said, why not? It's only a game, isn't it? He said, yeah, you don't want like one Championship game on your resume, do you? I was like, I don't mean nothing to me. I don't mind. Like, not a problem to me. But yeah, Bobby was funny saying, no, you can't play, Youngie. Don't play.
He didn't blink. You played. Do you remember your final day as a professional?
Picked up a big bag of boots and cleared my locker out in a bin liner. Came home and just said to the wife, right, that's it. I'm done. We're done. So it's funny, that last season when I was actually training with the 21s and going through the motions a little bit and finding it tough, I actually signed up for the London Marathon.
of course you did.
Yeah, I don't think anyone at the club kind of knew.
How did you get on?
3:23, I think. It's quite a decent time, but I don't think anyone at the club knew, obviously. But that was more for myself because, I knew I weren't going to get in the first team. I could run in straight lines fine. The hip twisting and turning was not good. So if I had a young winger running at me, I was going to struggle in games and stuff. So I done it more for me to get to the end of the season to keep myself in physical fitness and have a goal, really. So yeah, enjoyed that. Really, really good day, the London Marathon. But I don't think you should be a professional footballer at a club and be signing up for it.
Quite extensively covered though on TV. Were you not worried about being seen?
I had a black cap on, sunglasses. Yeah, I was in disguise as well. So yeah, I didn't put Young on my number or anything like that. But a good day, really enjoyed that day. And to be honest with you, it got me through that season because it stopped, you know, your mate saying, should we go and watch the football down the pub? Do you want to go to the boxing on Saturday night? We'll have a few beers, this, that and the other. And I thought, that's not going to do me any good. While I'm not playing in matches as well, so I just thought I needed a goal to get me to the end of like that season, and that was the thing that did it for me. And going out on long runs and clearing your mind, it's good. It was good for me.
Do you know what you should have done? You should have run it in full QPR kit.
Still don't think anyone would have known. I hadn't played for 2 years, so they still wouldn't have known it was me. But
did,
yeah,
did you train the next day?
Yes, I did actually. The lads who didn't play for QPR that weekend were in on either the Monday or the Sunday, whatever it was. And so I'm in the changing rooms and I'm sitting next to a few of the lads and I've got this big tube of deep heat and I'm putting it all over my legs. And they go, what are you doing? I went, I ran the marathon yesterday. They're like, what? Are you kidding me? So, I managed to get through that training session the best I could. That was not easy because you hear people moaning about the marathon the next day saying, I couldn't get out of bed, I couldn't walk. There's me running around training with like Premier League players.
323, very impressive. How much influence did football have in your family growing up?
Yeah, it was everything, to be honest. My brother's 6 years older than me and he went through the Tottenham Academy as well. So having him, trying to compete with him non-stop in the garden, whatever sport it was, kind of brought out probably the best in me as well. You couldn't lose in my family. If you lost, you'd be battered. You know, my dad, my uncles, everyone. Sport was huge in the young household.
What do you mean you'd get battered? You wouldn't get dinner?
No, you just get verbally attacked for the rest of the day. And yeah, it was more about not losing. You didn't want to lose because then you'd be the one that would get it, really. Trying to compete with my brother, I think, probably helped me in my football journey as well. You know, being 6 years older, there was no way I was going to win anything, really. But I used to be real determined when I was young. And following him as well, obviously, he went through the academy system and he did a couple of years pro at Spurs before joining Bournemouth and having, I think he was about 12 years at Bournemouth as well. It was great to have an older brother that was already going through what I didn't know I was going to, but obviously followed in his footsteps.
What did you ask him typically growing up? Because he had that experience before you, right?
Yeah, a lot really. Even to the point where I'm playing in sort of higher leagues than him, he's still someone that you would call up and say, didn't play well the weekend, kind of got done by the winger, and he'd have his little nuggets of wisdom that he could give me as well. So it was great having an older brother that had already gone through, you know, the professional ranks and was playing professional football.
Did you stand out as a player growing up?
I do remember playing in a school's cup final, and I think it's the first time I ever realised that people were speaking about me, was that the other team came in the same dressing room as us. We were sharing it. And I heard them go, "That's him, that's him." And I obviously realised it was me, but I didn't feel like I stood out too much. I mean, I already played for my district. I'd been at West Ham for a little while, and then at the age of 10, I went in and trained at Spurs. But I definitely wasn't the next child prodigy, put it that way.
Who did you support growing up?
Spurs.
So you're a Spurs fan. You're in the Spurs setup as a 10-year-old. That's a lot to deal with. Did you overthink it?
Yeah, I probably did. Going to training on a Monday night as a 10-year-old with a lot of the London boys, they were more confident, quite loud. I didn't enjoy it, really. I used to go there and think, like, am I good enough to be here? And because they were so loud, you kind of start thinking, oh, they're better than me because they're so confident and loud. And I'm from Harlow Town and they're from, like, Enfield and Tottenham and the surrounding area. But after a few months of it, you know, I got used to it, got better, started believing in myself a little bit more. And I remember when they asked me to go, I actually was thinking about not going. And then on the Monday, we used to train on Mondays, and came home from school and my mum had left a parcel on the table and it said, if you're going Spurs training tonight, open it. If you're not, don't open it. Obviously, I'm going to open it as a 10-year-old, aren't I? And it was the new yellow away kit, Tottenham kit. So I've opened the package now, and I so put the kit on and then off we went.
Did mum know what she was doing there?
I think so, yeah. She knew I was going to open it, and she knew that, she probably believed in me and knew that she wanted me to go.
That's nice. Did it have your name on it, by the way?
No, I don't think they really did that back then. You just got a kit, but you didn't really have the access to get your name put on it. I knew that I was going training at Tottenham and I knew I was fairly decent, but I never actually really came to the realisation that this could be a career. And probably until I was like 15 when they start talking about giving out apprenticeships. So as soon as you leave school, you'd go straight in and play for the youth team. So round about that time is where I thought, right, okay, so if I get an apprenticeship, I'm now on the road to potentially being a professional. But I also only felt like I just sneaked in to get schoolboy forms. I just sneaked in to get the apprenticeship forms at Spurs. I was never in the top 20, 30% of players. I don't think any of the coaches felt like I was going to be the one that came through. If anything, I was probably one of the lads that was making up the numbers. But eventually it clicked for me. I grew, I got stronger. Training every day was massive for me. And every year that went by, I got better and better and better, and like kind of closed the gap. And then, you know, ended up having the career I did.
And everybody has a different journey. This is information from an article I found on The Conversation 3 years ago. Of the 1.5 million boys who play organised youth football at any given time in England, only around 180 will be signed professionally by a Premier League club. 50% of all academy players leave the academy system before they're 16. When you join Spurs as a kid, because that's what you are. You're a kid. Did they have these conversations with you or your parents?
In a word, no, not really. Obviously, I think they do a lot more now because there's been a lot of talk about it. You know, they've got to do more for the lads that get released, because often you find the lads get released, they go on a couple of trials, they're unsuccessful and they completely give up in the world of football, where they need to help them a lot more, I think, because as you say there, in my age group, there was three of us that went on to play professional football out of the whole group, and only two of us kind of made the Prem. Another lad, the goalie, Alan Marriott, played for Lincoln for quite a few years, but so many lads don't make a professional career. And without being negative, you've got to let them know that, listen, this is going to be tough to get a career in football, and we need to help you along the way to think of, you know, other ideas. If this doesn't go well for you, then, you know, there's more to the world than football.
You were 19 when you made your Spurs debut, but you didn't have much time to think about it.
Probably for the best, I would say, yeah. I was in a bit of a group at Spurs where we was in the reserves, and it kind of felt like there was no pathway for us. There was a couple of older lads in it as well that probably were a little bit tired of training in like a group of 12 to 15 lads that didn't feel like there was any sort of progression for them. And one day I remember Stuart Houston, the assistant manager, coming over and shouting my name, saying, Theo, to the coach, Theo Foley, can we have Youngie? Now, Theo hadn't heard it, but I'd heard it. I was thinking, I'm going over with the first team here. So he shouted it again, can we have Youngie? So I've gone over with the first team on a Thursday, barely ever trained with them, like maybe once or twice before. And John Scales had gone in injured. Now, I wasn't a centre-back, but I'd played the last four or five games in the reserves as a centre-back. I go over there and the bibs are handed out. Stephen Carr, Sol Campbell, Luke Young, I think it was Andy Sinton playing. And I'm like, I'm lining up, like, never really trained with these lads, and I'm standing next to Sol. So Friday morning comes and John Scales is doing a bit of a fitness test. And if he gets through it, obviously I'm not playing and John will play, but he ended up going in the warm-up. So now I'm thinking, I've got a chance of starting here. This is ridiculous. And the bibs are handed out again and I'm next to Sol. Morning of the game, get to White Hart Lane. We're leaving from White Hart Lane to go to Upton Park, and George Graham flips the chart over, and there's my name next to Sol. So it was great because I didn't have time to think about it. Kind of just got thrown into the first team training. And from that moment on, I never actually left the first team. So it is funny how you can be in the building at a professional football club. You are good enough, because when I was thrown in, I never left again. But yet you're getting ignored. And I don't know why that is. Maybe it's because they're paying great money to the pros that were already there. But we kind of felt like we was in this like dead end pool of players that there was nowhere to go, you know. And then suddenly I'm thrown in and I never left the squad again.
So you're out of position initially, but your running mate is Sol Campbell, as you say. So what did you learn from him?
Sol was great for me because obviously being vertically challenged as a centre-back, back in them days, most other teams, goalie, or if they got a free kick in their own half, they'd play it long to the big number nine. Now, me and Sol would switch while the ball was in the air. So Sol would always jump and I would always cover around. And we had that understanding, and maybe he took that upon himself to say, I'm going to help the younger lad through it, and I'm going to have to talk him through it and be the senior pro in this instance. So we had that understanding that Sol would go up if we had time to switch and I would cover around. So, and in them days, everyone played two up front. So the big guy would go up to head it. The little guy would flick in behind to try and get on the end of things. So I would like sweep round Sol. But yeah, he was brilliant for me and brilliant for Tottenham. Not that many Tottenham fans would probably still say that to this day.
You have a lot of thoughts on that. So he plays for Spurs from the academy for a decade, I believe, and then he moves to Arsenal. What do you want to say about how this has all unfolded? Because as a homegrown player, you'd hope that these negative feelings that Spurs fans seem to have would flip.
I think if it was anywhere other than Arsenal, I'm guessing they would have been fine with it, because I think Sol at that time was probably one of the best centre-backs in world football, not just the Premier League. So if he'd have gone to Man United, maybe the Tottenham fans would still hold him in high regard. I think the fact that it was Arsenal obviously is the reason why there's so much hatred towards him. He'd outgrown the club as a player and he needed to be at the highest level with the Premier League. I don't know what was said along the way, like whether he said I'm staying or the club had offered him a great deal when he turned it down. I don't know whether there was any anger towards him for that. I think it is just because it was Arsenal. But the thing that makes me kind of laugh a little bit now is if fans are choosing their best ever Tottenham 11, Sol won't even get a mention, which is a bit ridiculous, really, because of how good he was for Spurs.
What was your welcome to professional football moment?
So I got in the side and played West Ham away, we'd lost. Second game was League Cup quarter final, White Hart Lane. So that was on the Wednesday after the Saturday's game. So my home debut was starting for Tottenham against Man United in a quarter final of the League Cup with all the superstars that are at United. And we won that day. We went on to win the Carling Cup that year. So that was a bit of a baptism of fire. But the one that I don't really want to mention on here because I've tried to forget about it was we're playing Arsenal at home and Kanu loops the ball over my head, runs around me and scores to make it 3-1. And that was a bit of, oh, this is a different level. I need to up my game.
When does football change from being a dream to becoming a job?
The minute you get in the first team and you realise how serious it is and you realise the pressures of staying in the team, training well. You're basically getting judged every day. So you go into training, your manager and the coaches are looking if you're sharp. Is the guy who plays in your position playing better than you? Did you play well the weekend? Have you had two bad games on a run? Are you thinking about making a change? Are they? So if you think about it, you've always got to be at the top of your game because the fans are judging you, papers were judging you, now social media are judging you. I would say that's where the pressure comes from. So you've got to try and stay in the team. You've got to win. These are the pressures that come with playing and wanting to be a regular starter.
So you've got to have a lot of self-belief.
Me personally, I used to have to train as well as I could. I had to be as sharp as I could. I didn't have unbelievable ability like some of these guys that can maybe take their foot off the pedal a little bit. But for me, I had to be 100% all of the time to reach the level that I reached because I didn't have the ability to go through the motions a little bit. So it was quite intense for me to reach the level I did. I had to be 100% professional all of the time and train as well as I could to stay in the team.
What are the potential distractions? What were they?
I think in my day, we were still going out a bit too much probably. Of a weekend, you would see Tottenham youth team players, young pros out in London, and in the corner would be the West Ham boys, the Fulham boys, the Chelsea boys, the Arsenal boys. Everyone was still going out a lot, trying to get away from the drinking culture a little bit, but also your mates in your hometown want to go out at times. And I like to go out and have a drink and a laugh with my pals, but eventually it gets to the stage where you've got to say, right, I can't do that anymore because the game's moving on. And the game did move on. I saw in my career a couple of times where it went up another level. One would be when Arsene Wenger came in. Another one would probably be about 3 or 4 years after that. The pace of the game and the Thierry Henrys of this world that were taking it to another level meant that you couldn't get away with that type of lifestyle anymore.
You mentioned Henry, so I might as well ask you, toughest opponents you've faced?
Thierry Henry.
He's number one.
Number one, yeah, for sure. He was just a different athlete compared to everybody else, I felt. And when he was in full flow, he was very, very difficult to stop. And the thing is, if you wanted to give yourself a bit of space because you knew how quick he was, he could then pick a pass as well. So he kind of had everything. I remember playing at the Valley. I think we was obviously losing the game and getting a little bit frustrated. And Thierry Henry used to like to come out to the left-hand side. And about 10 minutes to go, he's running down the line. I think, I've got him here. I'm going to take everything. So I've just dived in, tried to get the ball and maybe take him a little bit as well. So as I'm coming, he's seen it. He's chipped the ball over me as I'm diving. He's turned round. He's waved his finger at me as if to say, you can't do that to me. And then I'm just on the floor, almost in the hoardings, you know, getting up, trying to chase after him. But in the Premier League era that I played in, I think he was definitely a little bit above everybody else.
You marked Ronaldo.
Marked Ronaldo, but Ronaldo was a young Ronaldo that wasn't quite the finished article. He was towards the end. He was getting there before he went to Madrid, a couple of seasons there. So he would definitely be in number two. Pushing Thierry Henry.
I can't believe he wagged his finger at you. The cheek of it.
The disrespect. Yeah, no, I think I deserved it. I think he knew that I was coming to try and take everything and him, chip the ball over me and just give it a, nah, not today, mate.
Did you give him a smile or not?
No, No, I did not.
You played almost 80 games for Spurs, all out of position, before leaving for Charlton. And then finally you were right back. Do you believe that Spurs looked after you as a homegrown player?
Supporting them as a youngster, getting to play for them, it was a dream, and I managed to do that. I think when you come through a club and you're homegrown, they don't tend to look after you with your contracts. So you won't get the going rate. So you might be playing as many games as a senior pro, but you're nowhere near what they're contracted, unless you're special. Now, I got offered a couple of deals by Tottenham, and I'd already played like 70 odd games. And being honest with you, they were pretty poor compared to what they should have been regarding what everybody else was on. So kind of made my decision easier. I didn't really want to leave Spurs, but I think I was in danger of becoming a utility player. So like you mentioned there, I think I played 79 games for Spurs, but left back, centre back, left wing back. I played a couple at right midfield. And a problem I had was that Stephen Carr was playing right back for Spurs, and he was probably one of the top two or three right backs in the league. For one, it was good for me because in training I can see, right, that's the level that I need to get to because he's excelling in the league. So if I can get there, I've got a good chance of making a career. The only problem was I only got seen at right back if I was playing for England under 21s. So I'm not sure if Spurs fans even knew I was a right back at that stage because I was playing everywhere but there. And I think when you're getting judged week in, week out in the Premier League, but you're never playing in your position, yeah, it's difficult to do. And Kerbs come calling and he said to me, what you need now is 38 games playing right back. And it never dawned on me really before. And I was like, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, Kerbs, as you say, Alan Kerbishley, Charlton manager. And this is where you also get into the England team.
Meeting Kerbs, in Kerbs' brother actually was the manager of The Who, the band, the rock band The Who. So I've met him in his brother's house in Little Venice in London.
Bet you had some questions for him.
Had some questions, yeah. I wanted to talk about The Who more than anything. Obviously, he said to me, listen, you need to play regularly now. You can't play two or three games, come out the team, go back in for one, back out. So you need to be playing right back and you need to be playing 38 games a season to progress your career. And it was the first time anyone had actually really said that to me. He said, I can offer you that opportunity. If you're not playing well, I'll keep you in. We'll get you the games. I meet the chairman and we go to the Valley. I see the Valley. But what they don't do, they don't take you to the training ground. So I've signed, done everything. And then you go to the first day's training and you're like, well, where's the training ground? But yeah, it was what it was. It felt like a little bit like a university sort of complex. But what I would say about Charlton was everyone was in it together. There was no real superstars there. It was a real sort of team and a squad all trying to do the best that they could to stay in the Premier League. And we did that comfortably for a number of years.
Back in those days, you typically had to be playing for a top four, top five team to make the international scene.
Credit to what we was doing at Charlton at the time, because Chris Powell had already been called up. Paul Konchesky was called up similar time to me. I think Scotty Parker had been called up playing for Charlton. And then myself later after was Darren Bent as well. So it showed that we was getting kind of recognised and that the England scouts and the England manager were coming to watch. But as you say, when you're in the squad, you look around and majority of the players are all at the top four clubs.
Proud moment when you get the call. What actually happens?
The first cap I got, I came on against the USA in Chicago. There was a rumour that I was getting close and then the club called me, someone from the club, I think, to say, you're going to be in the England squad. So it was obviously on the off-season. The seasons had just finished. We go to America and I remember being there, and I think it was Crouchy's first squad as well. So obviously I knew Peter from the youth team at Spurs, so he was a couple of years younger than me. So I've gone into Crouchy's room and we're just laughing. We're saying, what are we doing here? Like in the England squad, what's happening? And we're having a bit of a joke about it. And Crouchy turns around and says, yeah, I just don't want to become a one-cap wonder. So we're laughing. And he actually missed the first game. So I came on in both the games, USA and Colombia. And I think Crouchy only played in one of them. So we're having a bit of a laugh on the way home saying, Crouchy, you need another game, mate. Otherwise, you're going to be a one-cap wonder. But the proudest moment I had in my England career was my next game, which was a qualifier against Wales. And I started it. So my debut, obviously I came on for 15 minutes. It was obviously amazing, loved it. And now I've got a cap for England. But the real sort of time I felt like my England career started was when I actually started in a World Cup qualifier in Cardiff against Wales.
You're talking about England. I'm just thinking about you rooming with Peter Crouch.
I weren't rooming with him. I think I had no one else to talk to. So I knocked on his door. So I'm a bit lonely, Crouchy. Can I come in? But great fellow, Crouchy. He was a couple of years younger than me at Spurs, but they did the under 19 league at one stage. So I could come down a year, and Crouchy was that good that he was coming up a year. So we had a year at Spurs together in the youth team. I think coming from Charlton and all these guys playing Champions League week after week, I think perhaps they look at you and think, well, he might not be in the next squad, or he's only playing for Charlton. And you start thinking, what are they thinking of you? So I think the first thing you need to do is to show that you can handle yourself in training and try and earn their respect. You'd feel like they're perhaps looking down on the lesser lads a little bit.
What you're saying then is you put a big tackle in on Wayne Rooney. How does that work?
No, I don't think he'd be the right answer, because he'll get you back. I'm pretty sure of that. When I got into the squad, Gary Neville was injured, and there was a toss of a coin between me and Phil Neville. Now, generally, people would have thought that Phil would play because he'd already played a certain amount of caps, but I was in particularly good form at the time, and I think we'd played against Middlesbrough that weekend, and Steve McLaren was at Middlesbrough. So I think he might have put in a good word as well, perhaps. And I was surprised to get the nod over Phil, and I started in the next four qualifiers, which was obviously a dream come true, really, to be starting for England.
It looked as if you were going to play in the World Cup 2006. Is this one of the moments you look back on and think, okay, I needed a lot of resilience because you missed out through injury?
I think it was April. We're playing away at Upton Park, and I went to shepherd the ball out of touch to get a goal kick, and I just felt that my ankle was stuck behind me and my whole weight went on it, and I knew something had happened that was quite bad. It was like a numb feeling straight up my leg. So I remember Herman Haraldsson running over to me and saying, "Youngie, get up, finish the game, worry about it tomorrow." And I'm like, "Herman, like, I'm done." The stretcher comes on and I go off, and I am thinking in the back of my mind, how long am I going to be out for, even as I'm on the stretcher, because I'd played the last four qualifying games. So you're thinking you've got a chance. I did actually get called up as a standby, and I was still injured. I was still running around the training ground at Charlton. I went to the camp in Portugal, the pre-camp, trying to get fit. Probably a little bit deluded, but I didn't want to give up on an opportunity. And when it came to, I think there was a B game organised and I hadn't trained yet. So I had to go and see Sven and say, "Listen, I'm nowhere near it. I'm not going to make it," which was disappointing.
You publicly retired from international football at 30. You were with Villa at the time. Was there a particular reason as to why you made that decision?
I think if you look at it, all of my appearances for England came in 2005. We're now getting to sort of 2010, and I'll be in a squad, then I wouldn't be in a squad for like three or four, and then I'd be in another one. And I used to watch Sky Sports going round, and it might say Glenn Johnson's picked up an injury, and I'd be thinking, I'm getting close here. Then it might say Phil Neville out injured, and I think, right, I'm definitely going to get a call. So it almost, I know playing for England is the highest accolade you can get, but I was going after people who were injured. And I was turning up, and I still wasn't putting any pressure on the lad that would be starting. Time and time again, the same thing happened. Like you say, I'm getting to the age of 30. Maybe a young lad can come and get the experience that I'd already had 5 years prior, you know, and maybe he can sit in the stands and be around the squad and learn what it's about to be the next fullback to represent the country for the next, you know, 5, 10 years or whatever that may be. So yeah, I made the decision to kind of retire from international duty. It actually happened after, I think England were playing Brazil in Qatar, and Gareth Barry messaged me from the camp and said, "Listen, it might be the wrong name, but Glenn Johnson's gone down injured. I think they might be contacting you." And I'm thinking in my mind, I'm eating my dinner with my family in Solihull, and the game's like 2 days away. And I think, right, so they want me to fly to Qatar, be jet lagged a little bit, maybe play for England, maybe not. And I just felt like after the years of not getting on the pitch, it was kind of the final now, really. I just decided that I don't want to be the bit part in a squad that and put no pressure on starting. Let a young lad come and enjoy the experience. At the age of 30 as well, my body was starting to creak a bit, and I had issues with my hip along my career that were tiring to deal with, but you know, I managed them and I managed to stay at the highest level for as long as I possibly could. But at around about 30, they were starting to, it started to take me a lot longer to recover from games. And maybe I should have been more honest with a few managers to say, I shouldn't be training Mondays and I'm going to need a little bit longer to recover.
You have firsthand experience of what it's like to fail a medical. You were supposedly going to West Ham whilst you're at Charlton and you've had this hip issue for a while, right? So walk me through what happened there and then obviously having to go back to Charlton afterwards.
Alan Kirbishley had resigned from Charlton and I just felt like it was probably a good time to, I'd had 6 years there, probably needed something fresh myself. So West Ham had come in for me. Alan Pardew had told me what he wants from me when I'm going to be coming in. It's like, yeah, great, no problem. So I go to do the medical, thinking perhaps my ankle might show up because obviously I'd had the ankle injury, but not really worried about too much, to be honest with you, until I get a phone call to say that I'd failed the medical. Now, I don't think you actually fail a checkpoint in the medical to say, oh, you know, that's fine, this isn't. But I think they decided that there was maybe issues with my hip that they could see on the scan that they felt might come back to haunt them, really, regarding the monetary value of the deal. So they're buying me for X amount. My deal's worth X amount. There looks like there's a little issue with his hip. Do we want to take the risk? And I think they decided not to. So my only real problem with the whole thing was that Alan Pardew never called me up to say, really sorry that we haven't gone ahead with it, but this was the reasons why, and I hope you understand that. But yeah, never even received a phone call from Alan.
It sounds like in football you get left in the dark quite often.
Yeah, you do. You never quite know, you know, what's going on behind the scenes. I think it's better now with, you know, agents going on your behalf and they're sounding out what's going on and what might potentially be out there for you. But I feel like that probably was the right time for me to have probably left the club. But when I went back in to Charlton, Ian Dowie was in charge and he said, Youngie, you're going to be my captain. So I remember being in his office saying, I don't think that's a great idea. I said, the fans know I was about to leave to West Ham. Everyone knew I failed a medical and was happy to go. So for you to now give me the armband going back to Charlton, the fans are going to be like, well, he wanted to leave a week ago and now he is, he's captaining the team again. So I didn't personally think it was a great idea, but he wanted me to be captain and he wanted me to have the armband for him. So obviously I'm not going to turn it down.
Three seasons with Aston Villa, that included back-to-back campaigns finishing sixth. I pulled this quote straight from Stephen Warnock's appearance on Under the Cosh. Luke Young, our right back, took the warm-up every day. He took the warm-up every day because the fitness guy didn't want to do it. Youngie would go out, pick up hurdles and ladders and get everyone in. I was laughing listening to that.
Again, with the hip, I used to have to go out early to try and get warmed up. It used to take me a little bit longer to get everything warm so I was ready to train. So I'd already be out there. Then I might grab a couple of ladders and some hurdles and do my own stuff and jokingly probably say, come on, boys, in with me. Come on, we'll do a bit. Like, if the fitness coach ain't here, yeah, I'll take it. But he's probably used his poetic license a little bit there.
Shall we talk about the mid-season reviews then that Martin O'Neill used to hold for everyone?
Yeah.
How did you fare?
Not great, I don't think. When I'm talking about some of my old managers, I don't want to sit here as like a bitter old pro, like I've got any grudges. I don't hold any grudges to anyone I played under, but I've got to give a fair reflection of my time under certain managers. Yeah, I think Martin used to have a thing. I think it might have been a little bit maybe reverse psychology. So I think Warney spoke about his one where he went in and I think we were fourth in the league and we was doing ever so well, not really conceding any goals. And I think Warney turned around and said, feel like I've done all right. And then Martin, I think, obviously told him how he saw it and Warney came out feeling lower than a snake's belly and really struggled from that moment on. But I remember, I think mine was like more like an end of season review. And I went in and basically I'd filled in at left back and excelled at left back for him and probably saved the fact that he'd spent money on Nicky Shorey but didn't want to play Nicky. So I went in there and he just said, how do you think it's done? I said, I think I've done quite well. I've had to adapt to like playing a new position. But yeah, hopefully I can do better next year, that type of thing. And he just said, you've done fine. And then there was a bit of a silence and then nothing else was really said. So I went back to the lads and then what did he say? I said, he told me I did fine. And then I was like obviously roaring with laughter because some of the boys that had been there before knew about his reviews and knew how sometimes he could be a little bit negative with the feedback that he'd give you.
How many days did you train a week on average?
Training at Villa wasn't probably as adequate as it needed to be with the squad of players we had. But I'm going to be honest with you, it really suited me because with my hip trouble and getting warm, I couldn't stop training and do a load of shape like and not be able to run around and stuff. And a lot of clubs do a lot of shape work where you're in position and you're going over tactics for the weekend or whatever. But every single day at Villa, we would do a game and the first 10 minutes would be one touch. So that would be just hectic. The ball would be going everywhere. There'd be hardly any goals scored. The second 10 minutes would be two touch. That'd be a bit better. And the last 10 minutes would either be three touch or all in. And you would literally train for 30 minutes and they go, right, that'll do you guys. See you tomorrow. But for me, it was absolutely perfect because I'd warm up and I'd get to be involved in training for all of the 30 minutes. And the intensity of the training was actually quite good because we had so many days off if we was winning that the lads thought, right, I've got to be bang on it in training because I'm not getting enough. So I think there was a few lads that wanted a little bit more training, a few lads that wanted a little bit more tactical instruction for whoever we was playing against. We didn't do any set pieces, stuff like this. But I think Martin was very much from the old school of football. And I think Harry Redknapp was pretty similar. Training for lads like, say, James Milner, for instance, he wants more. He wants to become better. He wants instruction. He wants someone taking him to say, what about this? What about that? He was inquisitive to learn and to be better. And we didn't really get that. It was just like Martin bought sort of experienced players. And I think his thinking was, I've bought you because I think you're the finished article. You're experienced enough as it is. I'm not going to tell you what to do. Get on with it. And that was the way he was. Could we have been better? Would we have been top four if we'd have had some bit more guidance tactically? I don't know. Because
you might know. Because the story of those sides were that they fell off towards the end of the season, right? Was that a result of how you trained?
Well, put it this way. I lived in Solihull for a year, obviously with the family, and decided that we're hardly training. We may as well live in London. So Stevie Sidwell had kind of made the jump already before me and said it was doable. We had some boys up north travelling down and it just made sense. We had so many, if we was winning, we had so many days off that in the end, we moved back down to London. And the train was great. I'd be up at 6:30, breakfast really early. I'd had so much like fluid before training. I felt amazing. I felt the best I'd ever felt than when I lived 20 minutes away. So for the last 2 years, I travelled up from London. My mate would pick me up in a black cab at like 6 o'clock in the morning, take me to Euston. I'd get on the train, hour and 15 minutes up. I'd leave my car at the train station, drive in, like looks like I'm driving in. Never late, never missed a session, always in early. And felt the best I'd felt for years. But the decision was taken because if we won on a Saturday or a Sunday when we was in the Europa League, you play Sunday, the manager would say something like, I'll see you Tuesday. And Youngie or Gabby would shout out, what's that? See you Wednesday. And the manager would just, because he was so, you know, buzzing off the fact we'd won again, he would go, yeah, you're right. I'll see you Wednesday. And everyone was like, oh, we're off till Wednesday again. And, you know, Gabby was flying all over the world for trips to have a laugh with his mates and come back and train and like that. But yeah, I really enjoyed my time at Villa.
I bet you did.
It's such a great club and absolutely loved playing at Villa Park. The pitch was immaculate. Fans were great.
Martin O'Neill left the club 5 days before the start of your third season at Villa. Did you hear from him? How did that all work out?
I heard that he had found out, I might be completely wrong, that the club had maybe spoken to Mark Hughes. That was a rumour that was going round. And another rumour was that he wasn't given the James Milner money to go and reinvest. Now, we're just about to start the new season. We've come sixth twice. He believes that we're getting close to maybe getting into the Champions League and this might be the year we do it. And I don't know, perhaps he wasn't backed on a transfer, or he didn't want Millie to go. Who knows what that was? But it was completely out of the blue. Massive surprise. I don't know whether anyone's actually got the answer to the reason, but no one saw that coming at all.
So as players, do you have to get together and have a little chat, or do you just carry on as normal?
No, you just get on with it. You just get on with it. It's like the stuff from like the board level and who's coming in as manager, it kind of just doesn't really affect you because you're so concentrated on what you need to do. Not a lot of time to find a replacement. The season around the corner, I think we literally had one game to go, which was Valencia at home on a Friday night before the season started.
I think a central theme of this whole conversation has been your work ethic, your dedication, consistency. Where does all that come from?
I was always the same as a young lad in the garden with my brother trying to beat him. I had to give absolutely everything I had to do so. And I think that kind of moulded me into every time I didn't love the gym, didn't really attack the gym whenever we'd done gym sessions, but every time we went out to train, I don't think there was many that would have covered as much distance as I did or put in the effort levels that I did. So I think I was one of those players that, like I mentioned to you before, had to be bang on it and tip-top physical condition to play the level that I managed to play. So I think it was knowing that I needed to do that as well.
Well, Luke, I hope it's been a cathartic experience for you to share your career. I promise it's the only time you'll have to do it for an extended period. You'll be asking questions next time.
It's been real fun to think back and go through the different clubs that I played for, and really proud that, like I say, I managed to play in the Premier League for so long and represent my country. If I was 10 years old and you said that you was going to have the career that you had, I wouldn't have believed you, for sure.
This is just the start, isn't it?
Enjoyed it. Yeah, can't wait.
Thank you, Luke. And thank you guys for listening and watching the More Than a Name podcast. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube. Get in touch with us by emailing morethananamepod@gmail.com and follow along on socials for more content at morethananamepod.